the programme, The Engineer as Artist, remembering Peter Rice. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight.
I have lived in important places, times when great events were decided. Who owned that half a rood of rock and no man's land surrounded by our pitchfork-armed claims? I heard the Duffy shouting, damn your soul, and old McCabe stripped to the waist seam, stepped the plot-defying blue cast eel. Here is the march along these iron stones. That was the year of the Munich bother, which was most important. I inclined to lose my faith in Ballyrush and Gorchin, till Homer's ghost came whispering to my mind. He said, I made the Iliad from such a local row. Gods make their own importance.
Patrick Kavanagh there. Kavanagh, a figure from Peter Rice's childhood and a poet he greatly admired. Peter Rice, widely regarded as the most original and distinguished structural engineer of the late 20th century. A remarkable man who left a huge legacy to World Heritage in his short 57 years, Rice was born in Dundalk, County Louth in 1935 and died in 1992. The buildings he helped to shape into reality from the dream of architecture include Sydney Opera House, the Pompidou Centre in Paris and Lloyd's of London. Describing himself as a dreamer with a love of numbers, Rice used developments in computer technology and new materials to shape his vision and in the process changed the nature of modern architecture. A new book on Rice's life and work, Traces of Peter Rice, has just been published to coincide with a series of exhibitions, workshops and conferences in London, Paris and Dublin. Tonight we discuss that book and Rice's unique place as a structural engineer with a passionate commitment to the art of the built environment. Before we talk to our panel this evening, let's hear from Minister for Education and Skills Rory Quinn, who launched the book Traces of Peter Rice at Dublin Castle last Thursday night.
Sydney Opera House, I remember seeing it for the first time and being absolutely astonished, and I had no idea that an Irishman had anything to do with it. But it is one of the glorious buildings of the world.
Not only is it a glorious building in the world, but it became the iconic image of Australia. And there was great controversy about its cost and the overall and the rest. But those things are soon forgotten. The contribution that Peter Rice clearly contributed towards the technical resolution of a myriad of problems is something I was not aware of. And I suspect most of the young Irish who are now, sadly, some of them not out of choice in Australia, are not necessarily aware that, this iconic symbol of modern Australia was made possible by a young Irish immigrant designer.
Of course, you're an architect by training, and in your speech you talked about the impact of standing in front of the Pompidou Centre in Paris and looking at this extraordinary building, which, of course, again, Rice was central to the design. Its impact is almost immeasurable.
It was so revolutionary at the time. It really, if you can imagine, was like turning Merrion Square inside out and putting all of the plumbing of Merrion Square on the outside and all of the drawing rooms on the inside, in a say. Now, that's not necessarily a very accurate analogy, but it's certainly sufficiently radical to indicate what they tried to do. They wanted to create these spaces, and they work as exhibition spaces, but none of the plumbing, none of the circulation space, none of the pipes and the tubes and the rest of it got in the way. And they, in a way of celebration and expression, put them on the outside. So it looks a bit like an oil refinery when it really is an art cultural centre. The radicalness of its design is embedded in its structure. Now, I think for operational reasons it became difficult to utilise, but one of the things that Peter delivered to it was the fact that they could vary the height. Now, what building do you know where you can imagine the National Art Gallery being able to sort of say, well, we're going to have an exhibition that will require us to move from 4 metres of height up to, we say, 15 metres, etc., and we'll move the floors accordingly. I suspect the idea was more exciting than its implementation. But the very fact that the concept was put in place and then the capability of doing it, and this was the real unique thing that he did, that he actually translated a visionary concept into something that could possibly work.
A man who should be more honoured in this country.
A man who should be understood and recognised to begin with. The honour will naturally flow from that. He is a returned stranger, somebody that we didn't know we had.
With me in studio, architects Sean O'Leary and Shane O'Toole, and Kevin Barry, former Dean and Professor of English at NUI Galway, who edited the book Traces of Peter Rice. From Paris, sculptor Vivian Roach, who says that during her career, she has thought of Rice's memoir, An Engineer Imagines, as her Bible. And joining us from London, architect and engineer Sophie Le Bourve, who trained with Peter Rice. Sean O'Leary, I think it would be fair to say that most people will not be familiar with Peter Rice or his work. Why is he so significant, and why are we remembering him now more than 20 years after his death?
Well, remembering him because his legacy is still very much alive. I mean, I can bring some of your listeners right through to Dáil Éireann and look at the visitor pavilions, and there's a very strong linkage between the technology that evolved to make that building possible and also a lineage of buildings that Peter Rice was a contributor towards. But that is just one immediate linkage with the immediacy of his legacy in Ireland. But perhaps the reason people in Ireland are not aware of him is the fact that his reputation is established internationally, and his legacy and contributions ranges from as diverse a project as Kansai Airport through some of the great legacy projects of the Grand Projet era in Paris, including the Centre Pompidou, the Pompidou Centre, and the Louvre, the inverted pyramid or the Pyramide Inversée in the Louvre in Paris, to name but a few. So I think the fact that perhaps engineers, even though they are quite a dominant force in the world, they probably perceive that they're not appreciated or loved as much as maybe some of the stellar luminary architects, and they often tend to get lost behind that kind of brand name. And indeed, Peter Rice is associated with some of those stellar luminaries or star architects of the 20th century. But nevertheless, the very fact that he is associated with them and acknowledged as a collaborator is testimony to his extraordinary capacity to collaborate, his extraordinary capacity to engage in the making of architecture as a synthetic process where engineering and architecture are inevitably part of the expression of the architectural idea. And I think that was his great genius, which is recognised from his early work in Sydney through to his latter projects, which include the lyrical and wonderful Theatre of the Full Moon near Montpellier, which in fact has little or no technology save the most romantic attempts to capture the reflected light of the moon to inspire tired and jaded actors. So there's a span of projects for an extraordinary man.
Shane O'Toole, Rice, of course, was adamant that he was an engineer, not an architect. And again, I think many people may be unclear about that distinction. Rice seems to have bridged the two disciplines, as you know, as Sean was saying, in a remarkable way.
He did. In fact, he was recognised in the year of his death in 1992, 20 years ago. He was awarded the RIBA Gold Medal for architecture, a rare accolade for an engineer. His own mentor, Sir Ove Arup, had also received it. But the only other Irish figure of the 20th century who received it was Michael Scott in 1975. So, I mean, if you have to put Peter Rice up at that level. No other Irish architect received that sort of recognition internationally from the architectural community. He was the godfather in lots of ways to the high-tech movement in England. That was really, I suppose, where he will be remembered for, not just with his two great colleagues, Renzo Piano from Genoa and from Richard Rogers, who met on the Centre Pompidou, their first project, which is the project really where Rice said his career began, but also with Norman Foster. So, for example, anybody who flies into Stansted Airport is walking through a Peter Rice structure. So we you know, he is everywhere. He worked with Arups for many years, but he founded another partnership in Paris RFR, and one of his partners there was Ian Ritchie, who has designed the Spire in Dublin. You know, his fingers are in all sorts of pies. He worked with Fry Otto, the great German engineer who did the original Munich Olympic Stadium, the last net roofs there. He worked on structures with him. So, you know, he is pretty much everywhere. He never worked in Ireland himself directly. He qualified from Queen's University, having been born in Dublin and grown up in Dundalk. He studied engineering at Queen's, where he wasn't an exceptional student. In fact, he only graduated with a 2.2 degree. So it was later, when he went to Arups and when he did postgraduate work at Imperial College in London, that he really found his feet. He was a great analyst initially. He could analyse designs better than most people, and where he made his name was on the Sydney Opera House in the 1950s, where he worked as an analyst in Ove Arup's office in London for 6 years, from 1957 until 63. He was having to write computer programs. He was having to write the software for the computer's programs to calculate, to make the calculations, because this was all pre-computerization. So he was actually having to invent the tools to make the analysis. And then, as pretty much as a kid, you know, in 1963, he was 28. He was sent out to Sydney to oversee the construction. Now, that seems an extraordinary risk for a firm of Arups to have taken, with a man so young, on a project that was the most prominent project in the world. It was either going to be a complete disaster and the end of Arups, or the making of them. And they put all that trust in a 28-year-old Irishman. Incredible.
Remarkable. And they were right. Kevin Barry, your background, literary, what drew you to the work of this structural engineer? Of course, he himself had a pretty strong literary bent, did he not?
Yes, I think I came to Peter Rice through reading the memoir that he wrote at the end of his life, which is called An Engineer Imagines. It's a fairly powerful title, and it's a wonderful memoir of a enormous professional success, in which he, knowing that he's dying, wishes to leave a testament behind him to explain what he had done. It's a very beautiful book. It's a book which is made up of chapters on his own life, on his childhood in Dundalk, made up on chapters of key projects with which he was involved, such as Beaubourg, the Centre Pompidou, about people who influenced him, Ove Arup and Jean Prouvaire, the French engineer architect. He's therefore in that book celebrating the span of his work. And I suppose what fascinated me was something which Sean has already alluded to, that at the end of his life, he was working with artists, for example, the artist Frank Stella, involved in trying to make a roof modelled on a sheet of origami, or trying to make a theatre using the minimum of light reflected on the stage under the most fragile conditions. And he had a wonderful sentence about what he was doing with these kinds of structures. He said, "It's weakness here is the essential quality to work with." And I think what fascinated me was a man who worked with light with regard to buildings, sometimes too much light, sometimes too little, worked with lightness with buildings, to make structures which were indeed monumental in size, like the Centre Pompidou or the Sydney Opera House or elements of the Louvre, and to make people feel welcome in those structures, because he invited them to look again at where they were, and he used surprises in order to make them feel that they understood the building and felt all the more at home in it.
The book you have edited, Traces of Peter Rice, a fascinating mixture of personal insight and professional analysis, and beautifully produced by Lilliput Press. How did that book come to life now?
Well, I think the book came to life now because in October, last autumn, the autumn of 2012, Peter Rice was 20 years dead. He had died at the age of 57. And he had been, yes, well remembered, but also not fully recognized in the full dimensions of what he had done. when he had written his memoir, he'd got in the first word. But I think also we wanted to give a chance of him having the last word as well amongst his colleagues and his antagonists. And so we invited a range of people to participate in the book being itself part of a process. So Peter Rice is 20 years dead, and a number of us thought, well, first we'll have a series of exhibitions so as to bring his work physically to the public. And that began in London in November, in Paris at the Centre Culturel Irlandais. It begins on May the 15th. Next autumn, first week of October at Farmley, it begins again. So in the three, as it were, centres of his life, Ireland, France and London, where indeed he lived much of his life, we wanted to bring Peter Rice into the public view. The book is part of that process, but there's another element of the process, and that is to archive what Peter Rice has left behind in terms of the traces of Peter Rice, drawings, maquettes, models. And in our research for these exhibitions, we were very fortunate to discover in the Science Museum in London all the original maquettes, pieces and models from the 1992 exhibition where, as Shane has mentioned, he received the Riba Gold Medal. So we wanted to bring him into the public view, to bring him also into an educational space. Next week is Engineers Week in Ireland, and beginning in NUI Galway, members of the School of Engineering there are bringing school children into a space where they have been asked to solve Peter Rice problems, and their solutions, they'll be presenting them to each other next week. And that process will roll forward through schools and primary, secondary, to the Farmley exhibition in Dublin, and will include children who are using, as he used, mathematics in order to make things that are beautiful and inhabitable.
Sean, Peter Rice entering the world of engineering and architecture in the late 1950s, and I suppose very soon involved in the great achievement of the Sydney Opera House. What were the major trends in building, engineering, architecture when he was that young man, and what did he do then that was new and unique?
Well, possibly the most succinct answer I can give is to point to the Pompidou Centre itself, which was probably one of the few manifestations of an avant-garde movement called Archigram, which largely centred on a number of theorists and practitioners from the Architecture Association in London, but not exclusively. There were elements of other post-war radical movements, which I suppose were looking at a brave new world. They were looking at technology as an enabler of civilization, possibly with overly optimistic in doing so. And I suppose the idea that of cybernetics, the information age and so on, all of which I think came together in Renzo Piano and Roger's entry for the winning entry for the Pompidou Centre, where he was assigned from Arabs as the engineer, and there the relationship came. And clearly the very expression, I suppose, of structure as an inherent part of a major public building, I suppose, harking back, perhaps unconsciously or self-consciously, in the minds of the architects, to the great antecedent buildings of the 19th century, like the Grand Palais and the Crystal Palace. I think Peter Rice found a voice. He said, as Shane rightly pointed out, that's where he saw his own life, if you like, beginning. So the trends, I suppose, were radical. They were utopian. They were centred on, I suppose, a great faith in technology and the human capacity to transform culture through information, through even at that stage through miracle grain. You had the Kennedy years, you had all the 69 revolution and so on and so forth. So there was an air of optimism. Equally in France, in the side, you had a socialist government. You had a long wrangle and probably to this day bitter feelings about the removal of Les Halles, the great markets from Paris where the site was. You had an antecedent proposal for a conventional library, and we often forget that they themselves are relatively new institutions in the human knowledge chain, 19th century. So What happened was, under Pompidou, the idea of an egalitarian, open, accessible space that basically made the information and the activities and the art therein the property not just of France but of the world. It was an egalitarian radical idea which very much reflected movements like Archie Graham, and he was part of that. And clearly his collaborators continued, I suppose, in different ways, perhaps, very different ways, but very definitely with a very strong conviction about materials, about pushing boundaries and structures, about materiality. And if you look at the pedigrees of Piano and Rogers, you'll see right through from the Lloyd's building through right now to, I suppose, the latest manifestation, London's Skyline, which is Piano's latest work. You can see that energy and, I suppose, culmination of a way of thinking about architecture. But I think that Rice's contribution, I think, as always, was to humanise that and understand it, and right down to understanding the materiality of what was a very old-fashioned material, cast steel, in making the devices that held the Pompidou Centre to the ground have an extraordinary tactility and understanding, which I think has characterised his understanding of engineering in a way perhaps that many other engineers lack in that in sensibility. So he in fact also demonstrated an aptitude to work with people who had a background in conservation, and perhaps a new generation of avant-garde people who perhaps had a greater faith in fluidity, dare I say it, like Zaha Hadid, who he's worked with. So in fact, over his life period, he did perhaps start with a generation who continued to manifest himself, but on the way worked with people who had quite not necessarily conflicting philosophies, but not necessarily as embedded in France and elsewhere.
Sophie Labourvy, describe the Peter Rice you met as a young student and what his inspiration and energy meant to you.
Well, I met Peter when he was already a very established figure in the engineering world. And so I was, at the beginning, searching someone who was working at the boundary between architecture and engineering. And his practice in Paris, called RFR, was constituted of architect and engineer. I was myself studying architecture and engineering at the time and trying to wonder where on earth I could practice at the boundary between the two disciplines, which are actually quite separate very often and not linked. So Peter I met through hearing about his work, mostly his work in France at the time, because he was building quite a lot of special structures, particularly around the Louvre. And I met him after quite a long pursuit. I had to sort of gain access to him through the process of chasing him in his office, and he was already traveling around the world doing lots of projects at the same time, so it was quite difficult. But when I met him, it turned out to be that he was a very accessible person, very easy to discuss, and he probably, that was one of his main qualities, is his ability to discuss with people from all sorts of backgrounds and all sorts of disciplines and make them feel at ease. And somehow he must have liked what he saw in me, and he invited me to work in RFR for a while, and then to London as well. And that was the beginning of the adventure.
And he was very interested in young colleagues and their work, was he not?
He was definitely. I think this may come from what was mentioned earlier about his involvement in the Sydney Opera House very early on, and when he was very young. He liked working with young people. He had a team of very young people surrounding him at all times. People who were probably no more than 35 ever in his team, but they were probably more on the 25 very often, and he sort of liked that enthusiasm. possibly that naivety as well at times. I think he liked people who were finding their feet for the first time rather than jaded or sort of full of preconceived idea. He liked inventing, and young people for him was the way to do that.
You've gone on to work on projects like the London Millennium Footbridge, that great bridge spanning the Thames. Has Rice's vision and ethic continued to inform your work?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, not necessarily in its architectural expression, because the architectural expression, of course, has evolved since he was at his peak, and people like Norman, like Zaha, all these architects have kind of moved on from that period of the very expressive high tech. But the Millennium Bridge is still a very expressive structure, and it has some of the continuity there is in the material, in the truth to the idea. The Millennium Bridge is a suspended bridge which goes from one side to the other one with a very, very slim sort of deck. And at the southern end, for example, it was actually quite difficult to make it work. There was lots of constraints, and some discussions were had about possibly sitting the Millennium Bridge on columns at the southern end, which would have really damaged the original idea of the suspension. And I used the idea that Peter had used on other projects, and notably on one of the ones I did with him, which is the Lille train station as part of the Eurostar line, to carry the rest of the bridge right to the end as a suspended bridge. So there's lots of material idea, lots of following his logic, following the logic of the project, and merging architecture and engineering, which came from my Peter Rice time.
You also engineered the second Pompidou Centre at Metz. I wonder, was Rice's hand at your shoulder at all in that project, or had you, in a sense, outgrown him by then?
No, I don't think I can say I've outgrown Peter, really. Peter is still way, way, way ahead of me on many things. But I think it is quite quirky that I ended up engineering the second Pompidou. The second Pompidou is from a completely different era. It probably doesn't have these theoretical backgrounds and ideas that the first Pompidou had at the time. But it is an extraordinary structure, the second Pompidou, and the difficulty of this structure is possibly beyond the one of the first one. And there I really had to sort of get back to Peter and get back to his ideas. I mean, there's a quote that I often use, which is I call the courage quote, which he says, you have to have the courage to start. And I think really a lot of times when we were engineering the second Pompidou, the courage to start or even to continue was definitely required. And that's where Peter was kind of, I guess, at my shoulder helping.
I think it's time to hear Peter Rice's own rich voice. This is him talking about the Sydney Opera House and his work on it from his address to the Royal Institute of British Architects on the occasion of being awarded its gold medal shortly before he died. And this is in the Arup documentary that's part of the current exhibition and can be seen, as Kevin said, in Paris and Dublin later in the year. Sound quality not great here, but it is worth hearing for Rice's own voice.
I've worked for 7 years on the Sydney Opera House. First as an analyst in London, then later as the resident engineer on site. I'd always had a certain capacity, something many of you must recognise, to do mathematics without necessarily having to get to think about it. And it was only really when I got to Sydney and started the building process that I realised that maybe the process of being an engineer for building could actually be fun.
The voice of Peter Rice. And, of course, the other great iconic building in Rice's portfolio is the Pompidou Centre in Paris, as we've discussed. Let's hear an extract from his memoir, An Engineer Imagines, in which he discusses winning the competition with architects Renzo Piano and Richard Rogers for the Pompidou Centre, or the Beaubourg Centre, as it was still called then. Rice had been to Japan and seen the surviving structures of the 1970 World Fair at Osaka, one of which featured large cast steel nodes. The reader here is Arthur Reardon.
An idea was born. I decided Beaubourg could be designed using cast steel as its core material. Of course, there are many other more important facets to the building and its architecture. The movement of people on the piazza facade, the piazza itself, the large clear floor plans are all part of the same intense effort to make the place a people place, where individuals can find themselves at one with this enormous monument. It was, after all, one of the express aims of the competition and of the solution offered by Piano and Rogers to create a popular palace of culture, one in which ordinary people would not feel intimidated. This sense of intimidation by culture was one with which I had a clear personal affinity. Coming from rural Ireland, where the only culture was a fettered freedom of sound and language by way of the technical departments of an austere Protestant university, places like the Louvre and the National Gallery in London overwhelmed me. The language of culture, alien and rigid and presumptive, was a barrier in itself. I really wanted to make the Centre Beaubourg an accessible place, a place like the Sydney Opera House or the Eiffel Tower, where you could feel good, not afraid and overhumble. Cast steel was the way to go. It became my contribution, a mission. I was, I felt, the most ordinary person there. I was determined to do my bit. Little did the bureaucracy know, or the industry, which later on decided that this fixation with using cast steel was silly, out of place in the modern era of 1971, that they were dealing with an engineer obsessed.
Arthur Reardon there, reading from Peter Rice's An Engineer Imagines. Shane O'Toole, the Pompidou Centre, of course, a remarkable building, and I remember the first time I saw it, the sense of joy and almost playfulness around it, that's somehow very liberating.
Well, yeah, I mean, the classic things like all the services, for example, being put outside the skin of the building. So it's like as if you took your intestines and put them outside your stomach, like a colostomy bag or whatever.
A bit more attractive
and painted different colors, color-coded so that you could see the water and the air and so on, the different services. But then facing the square, I mean, the most dramatic element of all was the people travelator. So the escalator that just extends across the length of the whole face of the building, so that people, you can see the people moving up and moving down. Peter talks about his contribution there being stainless steel. It was much more than that. There was trouble on this job. They were very young architects. They were Rogers and Piano. They had this was their first building. They had no experience. The building was initially way over budget. It had to be brought back down. Peter played a huge role in that. But also because Renzo Piano was Italian and Richard Rogers had grown up in Florence, so they behaved in the design team like Italians. And they flew through the crockery around the room and shouted at each other and everything like this. And actually, the French clients got quite worried about the whole thing at one stage. And there was an anxiety that the project could be killed until the clients turned to Peter as the sensible man. And he was the one who actually put manners on the two bull boys, as Renzo Piano called himself, and Rogers. You know, so it was completely an international milieu. Rice obviously had an amazing personality. He could inspire and unlock the dreams of architects and give form to them. He could convince clients that he was a safe pair of hands where the architects looked risky. And he was an entirely human person. I mean, he loved horse racing. And he loved soccer. He was a fan of QPR, you know, a really hopeless team in West London. So, you know, he was much more than just an aesthete, a technician, a brilliant mathematician. He was a completely rounded human being.
Sean, on the Pompidou Centre, you know, it really is one of these rare, enduring modern buildings that hasn't aged badly, as some do, or quickly, but retains that remarkable freshness. Is there any way of defining what that quality is, or is it that indefinable quality that is a mark of genius?
Well, it is. I mean, it has to be said that Paris, in their wisdom, reinvested in painting in recent years, and that shouldn't be unusual. But considering as Shane was pointing out, its rather precarious beginnings and the sense that it was essentially going to be a millstone around the neck of the budget of France and Paris for generations, Like the Sydney Opera House, strangely enough, there have been studies done to show how much the both buildings have contributed to the GDP of both France, Paris, and Sydney. So that's not necessarily a testimony to its endurance, but I think that in my humble contribution I to the book, I perhaps simplistically invoked Vitruvius, the great Roman architect engineer, and looked at the qualities he looked for in building, in firmness and commodity, and delight. And I think they were opposite, because I think that those criteria could still be used to simply describe the qualities you asked about, Vincent. And I think the Pompidou Centre, after all these years, and okay, in relative terms, relative to a Gothic cathedral, it's a nanosecond, but for a building of the 20th century to be in such good health and renewing itself is a testimony to its capacity to do just that. And it is aging gracefully. I mean, it comes across not necessarily with a patina, but with a freshness and vibrancy, which is its essential strength. So I certainly would like to think that with a bit of tender loving care, it'll be around for centuries to come.
In your essay for the book, you also evoke Joyce, you use four words from the beginning of Finnegan's Wake as the title for your piece, Commodius Ficus of Recirculation. Yeah. But you use that to move away from the stereotype of achievement by people born in Ireland, inevitably centering on great literature.
Well, I did, very precisely to liberate myself from that, I suppose, and also to celebrate not necessarily an Irish man, because he happened to be born on this island. I think we share shared a common birthplace. I think Peter Rice asked us as a nation as to whether or not have perhaps forgotten about about poetry and joy, and certainly as somebody who has been caught in the vortex of the construction industry, it's not a very nice time to be thinking about the achievements of architects and engineers, but to reflect on what that man brought as an Irishman, Irish-born man, to the world of architecture and engineering is inspiring. And interestingly enough, Peter Rice did not eschew literature. In fact, as Kevin informed me, he found a manuscript of a play that Peter Rice wrote in his latter life. And as Shane has pointed out, the man loved QPR, for God's sake, and he loved good food as well, and had a great sense of humour.
And horse racing.
I think that I'd really add to what Sean is saying here by a reference that Rice makes to his own origins in the book An Engineer Imagines, where he says, and I think we could take this very much in the spirit of what Sean is saying, that nothing in his early experience prepared him for what came later. And he was, as I think we're emphasising, deeply committed to risk and to surprise and to ruptures between what had become habit and what might exist. And he used mathematics to do that, and he used his obsessions to do that. But there is an extraordinary sense of possibility with Peter Rice. And I would imagine that for a world that he grew up in, there were great tensions also for him. Because coming from Dundalk, his career flourishing in the 80s, living in London, Dundalk often referred to as El Paso on the 9 p.m. BBC News. And the play that Sean refers to, that Peter Rice wrote fragments of at the end of his life, is called The Bridge. And it returns him to Ireland, where he thinks about scripting another life, where he would build a bridge between the two communities back in Ireland. So it's not that he left everything behind him, but that he was always open to the fact that you have to change.
And we'll hear a little more from his memoir about his early days later in the programme. But before that, Vivian Roach, you've said you've regarded Rice's memoir, An Engineer Imagines, as your Bible. What is it in that book that so took you and inspired you?
Well, actually, it's different things at different times, and I think that's why I can use it so extensively. I've had the book since the mid-90s, And I always go to it for the beginning of a project that might work on, because he kind of reinforces a sense of ambition, partly in the use of materials, because he's always exploring materials, using existing ones like cast steel, but in new ways, or else testing out completely new materials. And as a sculptor, like, that's of huge interest to me. But also just his whole tone about the making of, you know, shaping the world we live in, the simple act of building, how it's a communal activity. And he speaks about that so interestingly. When I'm working on projects, that's also the same for me. I'm working with other people. I've also worked with Arup, that company. And, you know, I feel I have that connection. My family, my father was an engineer and my brother is an engineer. So I think it's just a way of keeping in touch with my own real life to be able to dip into the book as I need to.
In the same way that, that Rice seems to have bridged architecture and engineering, he also seems to have been able to bridge engineering and art, as you're saying, in terms of now inspiring you as a sculptor. And that again, is quite remarkable.
It is. I mean, he worked, as we know, with Frank Stella. But for me, what I'm doing here in Paris is I'm looking at his buildings, some of which I've known already, but looking at them with a different purpose now. I'm making some work towards the exhibition that's going to be here in Paris and in Farmlee. And I didn't know what I was going to do before I came here, except that I was going to root it in drawing. Now I'm making two very large-scale drawings, which I'm going to turn into sculptural objects by the way that I'll frame them with maybe hanging elements to kind of mirror the way Peter himself may have worked on elements of the buildings. So it's fantastic to be able to do that and be able to refer back to the very things I'm actually looking at. For instance, I'm working, one big drawing is of a cast steel node member, the foot of one, in the Pompidou Centre. And it's not the obvious iconic Gerberette, but a piece of the building that's right on the corner of the street that people pass through and around every day, and just take these kind of very interesting forms that could be odd, but they live with them very comfortably. And I'm very interested in the way that people look at these and how these small engineering, or well, actually they're large-scale engineering details, humanise the buildings themselves and allow people to just pass by or engage in whatever way they feel comfortable with.
Do you have a favourite Peter Rice building?
Well, I would have started off, I think, with the Pompidou Centre, but I'm working on another drawing now and I've become really intrigued by Les Nuages in La Défense. These are... it's a very strange kind of cloud formation, and its only purpose is to give a sense of scale to the huge La Défense, the big arch, the Grand Arch, which is 110 metres high, 360 feet high. And as you walk through the void of it, it's a huge space. But these clouds that are hanging over your head, man-made clouds, give a sense of scale to that space. And I saw them soon after they were installed in 1989. And revisiting them this time, I just find them fascinating, much more so than I did the first time. I think they've kind of really held their own. They've become something very special.
And is there, Vivian, is there any piece of particular piece of your own work that you would say was inspired, very strongly inspired by Rice or his work?
Perhaps Enciarus in Mare Square was strongly inspired, not least because I was working with Arups and different people in Arups and understood the whole kind of team engagement of making something that's complex, that actually may look simple, but the bringing of an idea into a physical reality is always very complex for those working in building or in large-scale art. So I think that particular piece, where we kind of invented a material that was like chainmail but isn't chainmail, to act as a cloth for light, I think that particular piece is the one that was most inspired by the thinking of Peter Rice.
As I mentioned earlier, Peter Rice's wife Sylvia and his daughter Heidi were in Dublin last week on Thursday night for the launching of the book at Dublin Castle. They talked about many things, including their memories of his time working on the Pompidou Centre.
To be honest, we didn't really know the kind of projects he was working on until I remember when they did the Pompidou Centre and we all went over in the night to watch them bring the big beams through the centre of Paris. They had to basically close the whole centre of Paris. Yeah. And I think I was about eight at the time.
Yeah.
And it was just the most amazing thing. And we couldn't believe it. We were like, so what are you to do with this building, Dad? Yeah. You know, and it was all like, well, I'm actually, you know, the structural engineer. And we're like, what's that? Yeah. He was actually quite modest. And
Sylvia, I wonder, you know, going back to the young man you met and then married in the early 60s. What do you remember of him from those early days?
Well, we used to love film. And we used to spend a lot of time going to the National Film Theatre on the South Bank. And we would do back-to-back films, you know, spend practically all day there. We used to go to parties. And there was quite a lot because Peter was working at Arup's. And people were always coming and going, and it was good fun. But when I first met him, I was going to a party, and the person I was with at that time, we'd just broken up, and he said, well, you go to the party, and there's this Irishman that's working, just joined the office, and he's, you know, a bit of a loose end, so he said, I've asked him to come and you could go together.
Blind date.
Yeah.
Fantastic. It was like a romance date. Novel.
But the problem was, Peter thought I was French.
Not necessarily a problem.
No. And there was a book, Don Quixote, and on the coffee table. And he said to me, how would you pronounce that? And I said, oh, I think, you know, I've heard people call it Don Quixote or Don Quixote. And he said, oh, is that how they pronounce it in France? And I said, you know, I can't believe that you think I'm French.
So basically they had an argument.
Yeah,
first argument.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh,
but it was great. It was a lovely party, and we went home on a breakdown lorry because we couldn't get a taxi. And that was about 4 in the morning.
Oh, so big success.
Beginning of a great life together.
Yeah,
because we met up next day for a curry. And I had the worst cold ever. And I thought, well, this isn't going very far. You know, he's not going to. But he did. He was so lovely.
Did Peter, do you think he had a strong sense at all of an Irish identity? I mean, did he talk about
much
Ireland?
So, yeah. He wouldn't. I mean, I remember in the sort of 70s, it was really difficult because he was doing a lot of travelling, and every time he came back into London, he got a lot of hassle because of the whole IRA bombing and all those sort of things. And I remember you having conversations about, well, have you thought about just giving up your Irish passport? Absolutely no way would he ever do that. He was like, nope, I'm Irish, and, you know, I'm not going to give in to this. And so I think it was quite hard in London, wasn't it, in the 60s?
Yeah.
There was quite a lot of anti-Irish prejudice.
Oh, there was.
His buildings are his legacy.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
I suppose, the importance of a book like this is that it will bring his legacy to the attention of so many people and to the future.
Well, and I think as well it beautifully illustrates how he worked and how he, you know, how he wanted people. It was a collaborative effort, and he was very interested in encouraging new talent. And a lot of the reminiscences in the book are from people who were young engineers and young architects at the time, and that's the real... And he would absolutely love the idea that they still remembered their association with him sort of 20 years later. I think that would have been just the only legacy he would really have wanted, that he'd encouraged people to do amazing things. Yeah, and a lot of them have done amazing things.
He was very patient, I think. because he travelled so much. Mm. I mean, there was always problems at home.
He was always inquisitive and
sort of getting, you know, saying, "When's Daddy coming back? Because we've got so much to discuss with him." Living with this awful woman.
Yeah, you had to do all the boring stuff,
yes,
didn't you? I know, yeah.
And he used to take them aside and, you know, talk to them and say, well, you know, what's
the only thing we couldn't do with him was maths homework. That was a nightmare. Because he didn't do any working out. You know, he'd just go, "This is the answer." And we'd be like, "Okay, well, we'll just put that and see what the teacher says." That was the only thing that's a total nightmare.
Yeah. He couldn't understand why you couldn't see.
No, the process. There was no process. It was just, "That's the answer."
Sylvia and Heidi Rice there. Of course, it's a fitting coincidence that the Pompidou Centre, created by a neglected figure in Irish visual culture, is at the moment home to a major exhibition on the work of another neglected figure in Irish design, Eileen Gray. Shane, what are the other signature Peter Rice buildings, and how much travelling would we have to do to see most of them?
Well, we'd have to do an awful lot. We'd have to go to Houston in Texas to see the Manil collection there by Renzo Piano. We'd have to go to Osaka in Japan, where the international airport is Kansai Airport, built on an artificial island off the coast. Another one that hasn't been mentioned yet is Lloyd's of London, in the City of London, a sort of a baby brother or a cousin of the Pompidou Centre, I think. So his work is everywhere. But I think just if to kind of try and capture what he means to me in some ways is the title that he gave his autobiography is extraordinary. An Engineer Imagines. You know, the obvious title would be An Engineer Calculates or something like that. But it was that this notion of the imagination, of the risk taking that Kevin has been talking about. Again, there's an example of at one stage when they were designing La Villette. They were designing the Museum of Science and Industry at La Villette in Paris. RFR and his partner Martin Francis recalls in the book about how he mentioned to Peter one day that toughened glass is actually, you know, a bendable material, that there was a photograph of an advertisement of a 3mm sheet of glass, and on it there was a child sitting on a tricycle and it was deflecting by 15 centimetres or 6 inches. And when Peter saw the picture, suddenly, you know, a light bulb went off in his head, and he said, "Ah, well, if that's the case, then we don't, if this glass is flexible, we don't need a rigid structure to hold it. So now we can have a flexible structure to hold it, so it's cable stayed instead of columns." And there are two versions of that structure in Dublin, both designed by RFR, one for Buchholz McAvoy at Fingal County Hall, where the big curved glazed entrance is suspended in the exact same way that Peter Rice had that eureka moment about La Villette, and also CHQ down on the Docklands. The glass front to that is also a version of that cable stay structure.
And of course, another iconic feature of modern Dublin is the spire on O'Connell Street, designed by Ian Ritchie. And Ritchie formed the design engineering practice Rice Francis Ritchie with Martin Francis and Peter Rice in 1978. Here is Ian Ritchie on his memories of Peter Rice.
We got on extremely well. We had some common interests outside of engineering, outside of construction and architecture. We both were passionate about football. We both loved music. We both loved writing. And as families, we became friends. And I used to go to QPR with his family, and we used to do occasional things and have nice parties in my studio in Wapping. And the relationship just flourished. And when he was asked by the senior bureaucrats of the Établissement Public at La Villette to come and help at the La Villette City des Sciences, he asked me if I would be interested, and I mentioned a colleague who I enjoyed, Martin Francis, and that's how we set up Rice Francis Ritchie. And the common ground was, again, design and engineering, but also fundamentally materials. And it was a common language for the three of us that we all believed that the quality and the way we translate materials into buildings makes a huge difference. And in the book that's been written, composed and edited, Traces of Peter Rice, the reference really is the Trace de la Main, which is Peter's expression, which comes from the gerberette and an old lady looking at the gerberette and feeling it or wanting to feel it. And I think it was that haptic quality, the sensuality of materials, as well as pushing their engineering boundaries, which appealed to Peter a huge amount, and certainly to me and Martin. And Peter also brought that wonderful engineering gift, which was a sort of an innovative approach to the use of software. He was always on the edge in terms of what was being used. Much of that came from his work, I think, with Arup, but also with Fry Otto, when they were looking into tensile structures and then looking into spiders' webs. And those sorts of, I suppose, qualitative aspects in materials translated through a very, very gifted engineer who was alert to the latest developments in software, and the use of other consultants within the Arup group enabled boundaries to be shifted technically. And talking of boundaries, the one thing I enjoyed about Peter immensely as a person was that nobody was actually more important than anybody else. But equally, when responsibilities were necessary, those with the particular skills were required to be responsible at those given moments on a project. So the sort of design apartheid that exists between architects and engineers often was something that Peter couldn't tolerate, really. And that's one lasting legacy that I've certainly got from him. He also reminded me of that responsibility aspect, which is based on knowledge, skill, and wisdom. And they are important things which we tend to forget in a management-dominated world. The chemistry, I think, that Peter brought was the one of personalities. He was so clear in his thinking about creativity and his attitude and opinions and preferences. And to me, his ability to observe and be concerned for the engineer's identity in a, let's say, an image-making world that we have and was developing in the 80s and 90s. I think he wanted to make sure that the engineering exploration was real and tangible. And he wasn't just simply interested in the coup visuel, if you like, the sort of image-making aspect of it. And I think that, in essence, he was also very, very open about what he learned, certainly with me. And when things go wrong, people disappear when they shouldn't, all of these things have left a lasting mark on me, and I kind of miss him still, miss him a lot.
Ian Ritchie there. Returning to Rice's memoir, an engineer imagines that memories of his childhood include strong family connections to Patrick Kavanagh's home landscape of Inniskeen. Here's Arthur Reardon.
Even to an eight-year-old, Inniskeen was a claustrophobic place. Small fields, tall hedges and whins, with eyes following every move. Outside was more enclosed than inside the big house. Maybe it was the colour, the high, dark, brooding green hedges, threatening to engulf you for straying in their midst. As a visitor, there was no freedom to roam. The fields belonged to others. You could go where you liked, but you walked with fear, a permanent, heavy shadow covering everything. The house had one big field with a small orchard and a stream with an otter that I never seemed to see. And the border, 3 or 4 miles away. It was near and talked of all the time. It was how people lived, the border with its mysterious Protestants and Royal Ulster Constabulary beyond. Fearful is not a good way to be in the country. You get no respect, no right to be young and inquisitive. It was not the fear of what was there, but of darkness, which came suddenly with the rain, and of lightning, which, if it caught you, would dance between the whin bushes on the hill to test how you ran. It was fast and menacing, and made everyone afraid. Dada Quinn was gentle, but old, remote and unreal. Too many children had passed his way. I was his favourite, they said, and I do remember him smiling and holding my hand and testing me on mental arithmetic. I knew I loved numbers. They all seemed different with their own special quality. Each number was precise. It meant something. I could not read. It did not seem to interest me. But with numbers, I could play all day in my mind. Not like words which flowed endlessly overhead. I was happy with numbers, and Dada Quinn, in his stern way, was the only one who seemed to understand that. One summer, there at the gate, was the man who dug the ditch, Patrick Kavanagh. I was told he wrote poetry and had no money. He had been to the village school and was really above himself, but he was nice and could understand about being afraid. But then he was gone. Of course, it was later, much later, that I realised that he was a very fine poet whom I would have loved to have known.
From An Engineer Imagines by Peter Rice, and the reader there, Arthur Reardon. Kevin Barry, that book out of print, and it seems a shame. I mean, it really should be widely available.
I think that one of the important things now is to bring that book back into print. Its French translation, its Japanese translation, its Dutch translation are all in print. It seems really a small disaster that we should be doing without it. And it's something which I believe is doable during this year. And I think that we're living at a moment where, because Peter Rice died young, there's an enormous community there to contribute knowledge. So that presentness is there. And I'm curating the Paris show and the Dublin show. May the 15th in Paris at the Centre Culturel Irlandais, Farmley in Dublin in October.
Before we finish, Sophie, Peter Rice wrote a beautiful, compact and moving poem in the face of death, Time to Go. And before we conclude this inadequate look at his great legacy to us all, perhaps you'd read that poem for us.
Yes, I have prepared for this because this poem is difficult for me to read. I often get very emotional about it. So I will probably read it a bit slowly because it's the way I can actually keep in check. So the poem is called Time to Go. Tonight I know I will leave. The fight is done. And slowly, as I say goodbye, I need to speak and say my love for those close-knit friends. Support was what they gave. They made me live. To die, not old, cocooned in love, transferring through a point in time to somewhere else, a gift we have no right to ask, and it is mine. My brain waves span the cool night air and tap goodbye to friends unseen. Will they go on and span in time? My afterlife, I'd like to know.
Time to Go by Peter Rice. And the book Traces of Peter Rice, edited by Kevin Barry, is published by Lilliput Press. Thanks to Kevin Barry and our other guests, Sean O'Leary, Shane O'Toole, Vivian Roach and Sophie Labourva. Tonight's programme was produced by Sarah Binchy. Dave Gibson was on sound. From all of us, good night.